In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Mike and I discuss work-work balance, living a process-based life, angel investing, and more listener questions. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 308. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes that we made. Wait a minute. Was that the right thing? I wasn't reading it.
I don't know. Did you tell me?
Yeah, I think I was right. What is going on this week, sir?
Well, I started rolling out the latest update to Bluetick, and this is kind of a massive release I've been working on for a while now. But the core functionality of it is that it allows the application to download the actual contents of mail messages from somebody's mailbox. And the difficult thing behind it was actually that depending on which type of mail server you use, there could be a lot of duplication in the mail messages that are behind it. So whenever you move a message from one folder to another on a mail server, it doesn't move references around. It actually copies all of the data as well. So I basically had to run through this entire process of like downloading the messages and then trying to find out if they're unique or not and storing them. And it was just kind of a mess. And I don't think I've ever written so much test code in my life for like one specific function or for one feature, to be honest, because there's just so much involved in it.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Why is this important for Bluetick to have as a feature?
So people have been asking me to basically be able to surface the contents of the emails inside of the application because they want to be able to log in. And when they're sending emails through Bluetick, they want to be able to see the replies and what previous messages have been sent to the person. And the only way to get that is to download them from their mailbox. So it makes it difficult to be able to surface that. Like I can show pretty easily the emails that I have sent because I keep copies of those, but I don't have any other way to show them emails that have been sent prior to them signing up for Bluetick unless I go into their mailbox and download them.
All right.
So it basically provides them with a better history of all the different conversations. And it gets more important in a team situation because if you have multiple people who are on a team and user one sends an email to Sally and then user two sends a different email to Sally, you'll be able to see those things in aggregate. So you can see what the team communication is with a particular person as opposed to just your own personal communication with that person.
Sure. So the bummer is that you had to build it like yourself from scratch. I have to imagine there's not, well, I guess with .NET, there isn't as much like open source stuff out there to do this. I know that when we've tried to do stuff like this, we haven't done this exact task, but we've tried to do stuff like this, like parsing RSS feeds or just stuff that's semi-standard, but it's a little kludgy. Tends to have been a RubyGem written to do that we're able to use. Were there no components out there that took care of this?
Well, there's components out there that allow you to interact with a mail server and download the stuff, but there's nothing that says, okay, here's this backend storage system, and it's a very generic thing. We're just going to treat it like a database or something like that, and you can wire up those pieces. But there's nothing out there that directly translates a copy of the contents of a mail server into like some generic backend storage system, because the backend storage for it can be pretty much anything. It could be a database, it could be NoSQL, it could be, you know, file system, it could be a variety of different things. And all the components that I use to get the messages are all off the shelf, but the backend storage of it, depending on how you index things and how you want to surface the data and what specific pieces you want to actually store, those are the pieces that I had to build. And, you know, anywhere where there's questions about how do you search it or index it or anything like that, those are the things that I had to also build. And then making sure that there's tools in place that we can verify, okay, yes, we got this message and we were able to get the contents and we built all the indices and everything else. And then later on, a message might get deleted. So if a message gets deleted, then all of that stuff needs to be updated. And then we had to build tools to make sure that everything got deleted. There's no orphan data laying around, et cetera. So it gets ugly very, very fast.
Dude, this does not sound like fun at all.
It is not. It was not.
Yeah. So on my side, I want to call out a forthcoming ebook from MicroConf's very own Christoph Engelhardt, and his ebook is SaaSEmailMarketing.net, and he's obviously writing it for SaaS companies and teaching about email marketing. And he did a video interview with me today. I'm assuming that'll be included as a bonus or something like that. So if you're interested in that topic, SaaSEmailMarketing.net. And on another note, did you notice that our last two episodes went live almost 2 weeks late.
Well, that's not technically true. they were out there.
That's right. That is technically true. So, yeah, I got on Downcast, which is what I use on my iPhone, a couple weeks ago, and on the Tuesday, and the episode didn't come out. And I was thinking, that's weird. And so I went onto the website. Sure enough, it was live on the website. But I was thinking, well, maybe iTunes and Downcast got out of sync, because Downcast, I think it must scrape iTunes or something like that. And it wasn't showing up. And so it was several days later, and you and I finally dug into Feedburner, right, which is what we've used to track subscriber counts. And Feedburner got acquired by Google 4 or 5 years ago, and they have just let it languish. And so sure enough, something in there just snapped. Nobody cares or was willing to fix it. I posted to their forums. I tried to email them. There's no help email address available at all. Support bounced, support at bounced back to me. So I posted their forums, and it was just like it was like crickets. So we had to go nuclear on it and just switch everything over to a bare WordPress feed. The redirect's going. So hopefully everyone who's hearing this episode, it came up properly in your pod catcher. But if someone's experienced issues, feel free to get in contact, and we'll see if there's any edge cases that we've missed.
Well, the problem is that if they're hearing this episode, then obviously they're past the issue. So it almost doesn't matter.
Although a bunch of people were saying that they didn't notice because they listened to the episodes on the website. Can you believe that?
Oh, that's interesting.
I know. I would never have thought to do that. It just doesn't. I mean, they're on the website, but it's more for posterity, right? It's like I always think of, the main, and I guess the main consumption driver really is a podcatcher. I think 80%, maybe 80% of our downloads, because that was a cool thing. Like Feedburner would tell you what percentage came from iTunes versus like the Google downloads. And I mean, it just had all these different divisions of your downloads. It was like, let's say 10 to 20% web and everything else was like podcast apps. And then of that, I think it was 80 or 90% iTunes. Like it was a huge consumption. Although, wait, that's not true, because Google had, at least they had the Android thing in there that was like 20-some percent. So anyways, I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was nice to know. And we're basically not going to have any of that data now. I mean, we do still use Blueberry, I think it's called, and it gives us download data per episode, but it doesn't, the metrics in there are not very good. So this will just continue to fly blind.
Yeah, that's one of the downsides for just podcasts in general, is that the statistics behind them to allow you to see kind of what's going on and what your listenership levels are is just, it's atrocious. And I've looked around a little bit and talked to Craig Hewitt a little bit about it. He's from Podcast Motor, and they've looked into potentially developing a product around providing statistics. I don't know if they've ever went anywhere with that, but the problem is that in order to get those statistics, you really kind of need to know, or at least be hooked into whatever the application or the platform is that the people are playing the podcast through, because there's a difference between a download versus a play. So, there could be thousands, and it's just like RSS feeds. I mean, there could be thousands of hits to the RSS feed, but is anybody actually reading it? And you really just don't have any good way of knowing. And I think that's a very hard problem to solve, I think.
Yeah, it was kind of left out. I mean, since podcasting was bolted onto RSS, and RSS by itself doesn't have any type of analytics built into it, right? It just simply passes you a URL of a file, in this case, typically an MP3 file. And so what you're saying is that when someone hits your RSS feed and then goes and downloads the MP3 file, your web server has no idea where that came from. It doesn't know that it came from iTunes. It doesn't know that it came from a podcatcher, or if it just was just played on the web and was accessing it. So the cat's out of the bag on that one, and there's not really much we can do to put it back in. But I guess that's the state of things. We've been dealing with it.
Yeah. The other funny part about this is that Feedburner has kind of been on autopilot for Google since, I think, 2011 or 2012. So here it is, like 4 years later, and we finally decided to switch off.
I know. Well, if things aren't broken, it's like you're not going to spend the time and risk losing subscribers and risk potentially breaking anything. Anytime I mess with this stuff, I always feel like it's kind of like DNS propagation, right? You're just kind of, that it's probably going to work, but you're not really 100% sure until it does. And there's really nothing you can do to test it. You just have to do it. You have to click the button and then hope everything redirects. And if it doesn't and things start breaking, it can kind of suck. So, hey, we have some listener questions we're going to run through today. I think this cleans out. I don't think we have any more listener questions in the queue, which kind of makes me feel good, because we've had some of these listener questions in here since 2014. I'm sorry about that. Also makes me feel a little bad because people aren't asking us questions. I feel like we should get these coffers filled again. So if you have a question for us you'd like us to answer on the air, please send it into questions at startupsfortherestofus.com. So our first couple questions are from Anders 2 Peterson, who comes to many microconfs. You've heard us mention him on here before. He said, one question I have is, do you have anyone in your life that continually asks you the hard business questions? Those questions questions you don't want to hear, but you probably need to. If you do, how do you find those people?
I would say that I probably use my mastermind group for this kind of thing. So when I have questions or problems, I will bring them to them. But I also feel like in a mastermind group, you also have to be a little bit cognizant of the fact that over time you become good friends with people. So it can be more difficult for them to essentially challenge you on the things that you're doing and really put your feet to the fire to say, look, you're going in the wrong direction here, or you haven't made progress on this in a very long time. What's going on? And they tend to be more intimately involved in the things that you're doing. So they're not, I'll say, as objective. And it's not to say that there's no value in having a mastermind group, because I think there's a ton of value. But I also think that because they are much closer to the situation, like obviously you're the kind of that first tier where you're very close to it, and it can be very difficult for you to see the forest through the trees, so to speak. But in addition to that, like, your mastermind group tends to be people who are also only one step removed. And then if you have like a business coach or something like that, they're probably a little bit more removed from that, or just some even one step further than that would be people that you meet at a meetup, or entrepreneurs that you talk to at a conference. And those people are even a step further removed. And I think as you get further removed, it's probably easier to be more objective about the things. And in a conversation you'll have, you'll probably focus in on a few key issues versus the people who are very familiar with the stuff that you've been talking about. They won't necessarily question some of the assumptions because they've been there with you when you were making decisions about those assumptions.
Yeah, I think for me, it's same story. You know, the mastermind group is going to be the people who you feel comfortable enough with, or who they feel comfortable enough with you to be willing to do this. Because if you don't know someone very well and they ask you those hard questions, it kind of pisses you off. It's kind of like, who are you to ask me those questions? But if you know that someone has your best interest at hand, and that they're not trolling you on Twitter with a hard business question, but they're actually asking it to help you maybe face up to some shortcomings, or face up to indecision that you're having, or really to call out bad decisions that you're making, or just thoughts that aren't valid, I think that's helpful. And so it has to be someone that you have enough of a relationship with, that you trust, that they have your best interest at hand, and that they're not going to be a jerk and always ask the hard questions. Because if that's all someone does, it's going to get irritating too, right? You have to have more of a relationship beyond that. So I would say yes, mastermind group. The other one is my wife, right? So Sherry may not be inside the business and be able to ask the detailed business questions, but she does ask, you know, as she's hearing me talk about the same thing over and over the course of a month or 2 months, she says, how do you fix that? Why aren't you fixing it? What can you do? And starts prodding in there. And of course, she has the, you know, we have the relationship that we're able to do that. The question of how do you find those people? I mean, that's like we've talked about finding folks for a mastermind. It's you kind of got to build those relationships slowly, build them over time, meet them at MicroConf, that kind of stuff. So this is a good question. It's a good thing. I think more people need to think about this topic of like, who is it that is asking these hard questions, who has your best interest in mind, and who knows enough about your business that they know that it's the right questions to ask you. So thanks for sending that question along, Anders. Anders had a couple other questions, actually. He said, I'd like to hear more about how you handle work-work balance. I talked a little bit with Rob about last MicroConf Europe, about how much time he spends on fun work and how much time he spends on crap work. What do you do to notice when the balance is off, and how do you rectify it?
I like the phrase work, work.
Work, work balance is cool. Yep. I really like that idea of like, and it's basically saying not everything you do is going to be awesome every day or fun every day, but it's like fun work versus crap work balance. And work, work balance is a clever way to put that.
Yeah. But I could also see it coming from like a large enterprise 500 company where they're like, oh, well, there's work that you do for us that you do while you're here at your desk. And then there's work that you do at home while you're not at your desk for us. I guess for this type of thing, I would say that if you can look at the things that you're doing and you're finding yourself easily distracted from them and procrastinating on them, then those are things that you probably need to figure out how to address. Is it something that you just need to power through? Is it a short-term thing? Or is it something that you need to basically give to somebody else because it's frustrating to you, you don't understand it, or you don't have the experience or the expertise in order to do it? And I think that just being cognizant of what those things are and kind of how you're feeling about the work that you're doing is important. And it's one thing to just say, oh, well, be more aware of it. I don't think that that's the answer, because it's very difficult to become aware of it if you're not already, like if you're not already setting aside time to review those things. What I find is helpful is setting aside specific times at either the end of the day or at the end of each week, depending on what you think the appropriate cycle is, to review what you've been doing and where you've been spending your time and try and figure out, is that the best use of your time? So it depends on what type of iteration cycle that you're interested in kind kind of achieving. So if you're trying to avoid those things where you're stuck doing the same thing for several days on end, you might want to do a daily review. So even if it's just 5 minutes, just set aside a scheduled time, put a reminder in your calendar or do some journaling or something like that. If you're okay with like a longer time periods where there might be a couple of days or a week or two, then you could space it out and say, okay, I'm going to do a review once a week, Friday at 3 p.m. or 4 p.m. or something like that. When your week is essentially winding down, put something in your calendar that just says, okay, let me come back and review the things that I've done over the past week. So again, it comes down to what that iteration cycle is. But the really important piece is making sure that you set aside time to consciously review that, as opposed to letting it be something that creeps in and then is a problem for days, weeks, or months on end. And then suddenly you realize, hey, I really need to do something about this.
I think that's a really nice way to attack it, is just to review daily or weekly. Personally, I notice, because I start losing motivation and I start not liking my job. I mean, that's what it is. Even when I'm the founder or the co-founder of the company, when I stop liking my job for weeks on end, I realize I'm doing too much crap work and I need to figure out what it is. And then I start taking notes at work, right? Keeping a bulleted list of like, what did I do today that sucked? And I'll do it as I'm going through it. So I don't do it reflectively, but I'll realize like, I'm just sitting here in my inbox for 5 hours. Okay, I need to figure that out. And mention this several times in year-end reviews of like, I need to do less email. So that was one thing that was always there. Legal and kind of, I don't know, administrative stuff and HR. And there was just a bunch of things that I kept noticing that would creep up as we were growing Drip. And so it's work that had to get done, but it was work that I didn't enjoy. So typically I will just pick up on it because I'll notice that I'm not enjoying stuff. And then instantly the way I try to rectify it is identify it, make a list, and then say, who can I hire to do this instead? Like a specialist who is really good with HR, really good with administrative. Because most of the things you consider crap work is a job for someone else, and it's something they enjoy, and it's just about finding the right person to do that for you.
One thing you mentioned in there that I think is probably not inherently obvious to everyone is that when you're building your own business and running it, you would think that, oh, this is going to be great. I have a job that I love because I built this job in order for me to enjoy it. But the problem is that there are going to be aspects of running a business that you don't enjoy. And I think it's just important to keep that in mind, that not everything about the business is going to be something that you enjoy. And there's some things you're just going to have to power through. And then there's the other things where you're going to want to find somebody else to do them.
And then Andrew's last question was, have you ever noticed how most, and he puts in quotes, normal people, and I like that phrase, normals versus like technologists is a phrase that I've heard, but he says, have you ever noticed how most normal people live an event-based life? When I win the lotto, then I will become happy. When I get a new car, then I will be happy. Whereas it feels like most successful entrepreneurs live a process-based life. I work on my business because it makes me happy and because long-term it'll pay off. What is your take on this and where are you?
I would have to agree with the general assessment that a lot of people do live their lives that way, and they are always working towards these goals, but they don't necessarily enjoy the process. They're looking specifically for achieving that goal, but they don't really look anything beyond that, and they will make any number of sacrifices during that process, thinking that it's the I have arrived fallacy that you've kind of mentioned here on the podcast before. You get to that point, and then suddenly the question is, what's next? You know, what do you do from there? And if you don't have an answer for that, then it becomes very difficult to go on to the next thing, regardless of whether or not you were successful with the previous one or not. So you really have to think a little bit longer term about it. And I don't think this probably matters so much for people who are non-entrepreneurs, because they have a 9-to-5 job. They go into work every day. And at the end of the day, they go home and they work on their hobbies and spend time with their family. And it doesn't matter, because no matter what happens, they still have to go back to work the next day. But that's probably less of a problem for those types of people than it is for entrepreneurs, because entrepreneurs in that situation where you could have a life-altering event, which is much more likely to happen, such as selling your business or selling your product, than winning the lottery.
Yeah, by its very nature, entrepreneurship is a constant state of foregoing present gains for potential future rewards, right? Your present day gains are things that you could go out to happy hour, you could hang around and watch a movie, you could spend time with your family, there's a ton of things that you could do that are fun. But instead of that, tonight you're going to spend 3 or 4 hours writing code, building your business, doing some marketing. And over the weekend, you're not going to go out of town and go to the beach. You're going to spend it writing sales copy and thinking through your pricing and that kind of stuff. And so that's pretty much a perpetual state of affairs, as far as I'm concerned, as an entrepreneur. So, I mean, I think Anders, you know, you've made some generalizations here that I think are fairly accurate. I think people who are drawn to entrepreneurship, they have to know, they just know they're investing for something better in the future. And so I do think that there is that mix of, I think you can have the arrival fallacy as an entrepreneur, because you could say, man, once I quit my job, then I'll be happy. Once I sell my app, then I'll be happy. It's easy to slip into that. But I do think that the healthier and the long-term entrepreneurs who make this more of a sustainable lifestyle realize that at a certain point, you just have to be in it for the process. You have to be in it for, you have to find something in it that gives you that, it's the dopamine rush, right? And for some people, that's, Derek and I have talked about this. For some people, it's shipping a feature, like it's pushing a feature into production, and that's the rush you need. And so you got to find that and figure out how to make that more of a part of your day. For other people, it's doing launches and then figure out, well, can I do an ebook launch every other month for marketing? Could I do a video course launch? Even if you have a SaaS app, like if what you really want to do is launch little products, because that's where you get the rush from, then figure out how to do that. If you really love building a team, like a high performing team and working with them to solve problems, then figure out how to do that. You know, that's what it is, I think, is becoming happy and fulfilled by engineering a business, you know, rather than going for the end result. I think the end result, I mean, we talked about this with the Bill Walsh episode, right? Where it's like, he basically says, like, put your best effort in, do the best you can, and the score will take care of itself. And that's how I view this, is like, the more you can make sure that you're happy and that you're keeping those around you happy and making it a sustainable lifestyle, I think that good things will come of it eventually. Our next question comes from Kevin from Viper.io. And he says, just wanted to jump in on a question. I love the show. I've been listening religiously and it's overtaken all of my other podcasts. I have a question for you and hopefully you'll have a chance to answer it. Rob, you say you do angel investing in these fund strap startups. How do you make a return on those? I know some investors take a percentage of profits every month or something like that. Is that the structure you work with, or are you banking on an exit? Have you made a return yet on any of those investments? And so the fund strapping is where someone's basically trying to raise a small round. It's typically between, let's say, 50K and maybe $200,000-$300,000, and it's to get to profitability. So they're not looking to raise a Series A, B, and a C. They're really just looking to raise a small round and grow quicker, but to get to profitability. Last question is, have you made a return on any of these investments? The answer is no, and I wouldn't have expected to. I mean, my first angel investment was maybe 3 or 4 years ago. That was WP Engine, and it's now worth $1 billion. I think their most recent round, this is public info, but the most recent round was over a year ago, and I think they were valued at $120 million. So certainly my investments are on paper worth substantially more than when I first invested, but that would be the business that's furthest along, and there's been no liquidity event or anything like that. Another part of his question is, how am I going to make a return on these? So some of my investments are in big startups like WP Engine that are going to either get acquired or they're going to IPO. You know, there's going to be a big liquidity event, they call it. A chunk of mine, and kind of what I'm focused on now, because it just fits more with who I am and the businesses that I believe have reasonable valuations, are the ones that are going to be profitable businesses. I mean, these are not these moonshot businesses. They're businesses like Jordan Gal's Cart Hook and Justin McGill's Lead Fuse and Churnbuster from Matt and Joel. I'm an angel investor in each of those. And these are businesses that I believe they all absolutely have the potential to get to seven figures and maybe eight figures in revenue. And they're going to be businesses that just spit out cash. I mean, they're all SaaS businesses. And so gross profit on SaaS apps can be between 50% and 80% something, and net profit can be between 20% and 70%, depending on how you're running it, how fast you're growing, all this stuff. So there's a lot of money that can, a lot of cash that can come out of these. So yeah, the deal typically is structured, and this is the same deal you see at indie.vc, is the money goes in, as long as the money's being used to grow the business, nobody takes any out. But as soon as dividends come out, a certain percentage goes to the investors. And some of the deals say once the investors are paid back 3x, then, you know, things revert to a smaller amount that goes back to the investors. Sometimes the investors get completely paid off and they actually are paid out, you know, maybe at 5x. I think that's how IndieVC works. If they're paid 5x, then they now have 0% of the company anymore. And it's only if the company were acquired before then, you know, that the Indie.vc would get it. I think that's how it works. Don't quote me on that. But so that's the idea. Yeah. And each deal is different. I don't want to talk specifically, you know, about the investments because the paperwork's private. The idea is that yes, while it's used to grow the business, nobody is making money. I mean, the founders are taking a salary, but there's no dividends coming out to anyone. And then once they start taking that, a certain percentage, which is negotiable and it's a different setup on each deal. Sometimes it's based on how much you actually own. If you own 1% of the company, you get 1% of the dividends. In the others, the investors are favored more upfront until they get paid back their initial investment, 1 to 2x, and then it flips. So that's the basic structure.
Yeah, I like the NDVC model, and I don't know whether they kind of pioneered that or they're responsible for that, pushing that forward, or they were the first or whatever. But I like that idea better than the VC model, just because it's more in favor of the entrepreneurs who are building it. And I don't think that you need this massive exit in order for it to make it worth it. I mean, I don't know what your feeling or take on this is, but it's, in many cases, it's not necessarily because you want to have this giant payout, but you want to see somebody be successful. You don't want it to be a go big or go home. You want it to be something that somebody can grow into a viable and profitable business.
That's right. And those are the kind of businesses that I believe in anyways, right? Those are the businesses that I want to see succeed. And so that's why I've started doing this model. And Indie.bc, I have seen their, you know, kind of their investor deck for people who become LPs in their fund, the people who actually give the money to Indie.bc to invest. And they're, you know, they're doing well with it. So there's definitely returns to be had in this fashion. This is actually all modeled after brick and mortar businesses. Like if you wanted to start a restaurant or a car wash and you went to investors, a typical structure for that is that the investors do put up the money and you take a salary as you run it. And then as profits are generated and they're taken out as dividends, more goes to the investor. And it's often 80-20. 80% goes to the investors until they're paid back either 1 or 2x, and then 20% comes out to the founders, and then it flips at a certain point. And then sometimes there's a maximum payout. You know, again, the Indie.bc, you know, 3x or 5x, I think is where it maxes out. With brick and mortars, I'm not sure if it ever maxes out or how that goes. But so I think it's more about a business that generates revenue, is not looking for this liquidity event, right? And in that sense, like, you know, it's funny, an app like SaaS app like Drip, whose long-term play was to just become a profitable business, has almost more in common than a dry cleaner or a car wash in terms of the business model than it does with a Facebook or a Twitter, where they really need to get massive or else they're just going to self-destruct. Our last question of the day comes from Jordy Kosky from tapfun.com. He says, "Hey guys, big fan of the show. I'm wondering how you would structure a salary for a lead developer on a SaaS app. Would you build in any kind of performance structure related to revenue and revenue growth of the service?"
I think that when you're looking at this type of question, there's two different ways that you can view it, or two different perspectives you can have. The first one is, what role does that developer actually have in the development of the product? Are they a W-2 employee, or are they a external third-party contractor? And I think that depending on the answer to that, it's going to heavily impact how you treat that person in terms of the compensation. So for a W-2 employee, obviously you're going to give them a salary, and this is really where the questions come in about giving them additional compensation or performance structure. If they're an external contractor or third party that you just hired off of Upwork or, you know, off of LinkedIn or something like that, chances are really good that there's not going to be any sort of performance bonuses or anything like that. You've kind of negotiated whatever the contract rate is with them, and that's what you pay them. And it doesn't really matter what their performance is, like, that's what you're going to pay them. If they're a W-2 employee, then chances are good that this is where those questions will come in. And I think that in the case of developers, the vast majority of developers, there's not going to be any sort of performance bonuses, because it's going to be very difficult to map the things that they bring to the table to the growth of the products. It's very easy to write tens of thousands of lines of code that don't really contribute to the bottom line in any measurable way. It's very difficult to map those lines of code back to the performance of the product. You can write tens of thousands of lines of code that have zero to do with the product's growth. That's really what sales reps are for. That's what the compensation plans for sales reps and people like that do. It's to help them promote the product and incentivize them to grow the product. And they will do anything that they can in order to do that. But with a developer, those mappings are much more nebulous. It's very difficult to derive the impact of the product based on what it is that they do. So those are probably my general thoughts on it in terms of offering equity or a stock plan or anything like that. that. Those things are all negotiable. It really depends on what your relationship is with the developer and also what your company culture is like, how much money the app is making. You could do profit sharing or revenue sharing, those types of things. There's lots of different ways to go, but it's also very situationally dependent. And I don't think these are things that you have to look at or even really need to consider on day one when somebody comes in. If you have a team of 5 or 10 people, then maybe it's something to think about. But for your first developer or two, I wouldn't worry about it at all.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you have to think about A, motivation, and B, what's kind of a standard and why has that arisen? And the standard is not to give anybody but salespeople a cut of profits. I mean, that's typically the thing. Even people in marketing, as a rule, at startups, they're not getting a percentage. You know, they may get a bonus at some point, or they may get a lot of stock options, but they don't get a cut of the profits because you need those profits to grow. Especially a small SaaS app, you really want that money. So I think something like stock options, which is really good for retention because they vest over several years, I think that's cool because then someone feels like they have ownership. Also think about motivation. Like, are developers motivated by money? I mean, some, yeah, maybe, but developers are much more motivated by having really cool problems to solve and working in an environment that's fun and being able to ship a lot of code quickly. And, you know, there's certain things that are just more valuable than a few $1,000 bonus that they're going to receive each quarter or each year. So that's not something I've seen done, and it's not something I would particularly recommend. Giving, you know, people bonuses at some time during the year or doing profit share or doing setting up some plan later down the line, I think totally makes sense, right? You want to take care of your people. If your business is minting money, you should share it with them. And giving people stock ownership is cool. I mean, there's a bunch of things you can do, but upfront, having that be part of the deal from the start, I think is really tough. I think you could easily give away a lot more than you need to or want to because you just don't know what the business is going to look like. Like, get further down the road, get this thing live. And once things start happening, then kind of make that call.
As you mentioned kind of early on in that answer, like, it also depends on what their motivations are. So just thinking about giving them equity. Some people might not care about equity at all. So you have to understand what their motivations are for that kind of thing as well. I mean, it may not impact their productivity in any way, shape, or form, and then you just gave away part of the company. So you have to keep those things in mind as well. And I think that those things take time. They're not something that you want to necessarily decide on day one. So I think that about wraps us up for the day. If you have a question for us, call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690 or email it to us at questions@startupstherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups and visit startupstherestofus.com for a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.